Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
And this morning's programme, in association with University College Dublin, marks 50 years of the Belfield campus at UCD. This is Sunday Miscellany, Belfield Days.
It was early March 1979, and I left the UCD campus mid-afternoon and went to my bedsit, a little back room over a shop in Windy Arbour. £5 a week. Now, normally, I haunted Belfield morning, noon and night. The arts block was my stately pleasure dome, my wonderful everyday and my Sunday best. My bedsit was for sleeping in and writing last-minute essays in. Being there in the afternoon was just weird. Even stranger, I fell asleep. When I woke, it was dark and, not having turned on the two-bar electric fire, very, very cold. Through the grogginess, something dawned on me and I checked the time. Oh God, it was sometime after 8 p.m. and you see, I was acting in a play in Dramsock that had started at 8. But let's rewind a bit. 2 years before, in Freshers' Week, Dramsock was one of the 10 or so college societies I joined once I got over the shock that the University Drama Society did not operate from an ancient ornate hall with a raised stage, my 17-year-old's notion of theatre. Dramsock HQ was a cold black box space in the basement of the arts building called, with little regard for the romance of it all, LG1. Folding doors gave access to the equally glamorous LG2. Nonetheless, production photos on display of the previous year's triumph, Shakespeare's Richard II, suggested that some kind of magic could be created. I parted with my precious 50p and joined. Some of my new college friends were convinced I was wasting my money. Dramsock was a clique, weird types, a nest of homosexuals, an appalling stereotype, which I'm very glad to say I discovered to be largely true. But the notion that this coven was unfriendly was not. The very first time I summoned up the courage to audition for a play, The Bedsitting Room, by my comic hero Spike Milligan, I was welcomed and cast in a leading role. So here I was, starting my college life, acting in a play called The Bedsitting Room, and renting my own bedsitting room. I was free as a bird. I became, I admit, an inordinately selfish member of Dramsock. And not for me, the tiresome business of hunting down props, sticking up posters or manning the box office. I acted. I soaked up applause and laughter. Even learning lines was a tedious necessity, though I usually got there by opening night while testing the nervous systems of my more studious fellow performers. But I'd never ever missed a performance. So waking up in my bedsit when the show I was in had already started was a new and scary experience. The play, by the way, was Brand by Ibsen, directed by Dr. Joseph Long, a lecturer in the French department. Remember the Richard II production photographs that had impressed me in Freshers' Week 2 years before? He directed that. Something of a Dramsock legend, everyone wanted to be in a Joe Long production, including myself. Although, dark secret, I'd read Ibsen's Brand and thought it was spectacularly boring. When Joe offered me the minor role of the provost, I found myself experiencing a very peculiar form of envy. I really disliked the play, but was furious not to have been offered the lead role. Perhaps waking after curtain time was some unconsciously psychotic howl of rage against Ibsen, Brand, Dr. Joseph Long, and the whole wretched production. Well, I had no time to consider this fascinating psychological question because I was grabbing a coat in the dark and cantering from my bedsit out under the shadow of Dundrum Mental Hospital, along Bird Avenue, spinning left and then right at the Clonsky entrance to Belfield and sprinting down the ridiculously long avenue past dark playing fields and the looming water tower to the science block and the lake into the maw of the arts building and down, down to the basement and LG1. It was almost 9 o'clock. Through the buzzing interval crowd, I spotted three faces huddled together in tense conversation. The auditor of Dramsock, the stage manager, and Dr. Joseph Long. And now a reveal. An anticlimax, perhaps. I had reluctantly accepted a smaller role in Brand. I did not mention that the character of the provost did not appear until the second half, when, as it happens, he had quite a big scene, but that's by the way. So though I had been AWOL for the entire first half and created serious trauma for the production team, I had not actually missed my bit. Joe Long glared at my sweating, panting self and was brief. Get changed, please. In the gloom of LG2, he who had been about to read in my part clambered out of the soutane and amusing hat that was my costume, and without a whiff of warm-up, on I went. My scene, well, I remember nothing about it. It was fine, I think. Everything had worked out fine, really. Afterwards, as I was getting out of my costume, I saw Joe coming towards me. I sighed and thought, here we go. Remember, this director was not a fellow student. He was Dr. Joseph Long of the French department. I was resigned to a terrible tirade, a monumental dressing down. Joe spoke in a cold but very even voice. You may have no respect for your own work, Jerry, but please have some respect for mine. And he walked away. That I can remember his words precisely, 42 years later, indicates the intensity of their effect. No lengthy harangue could have humbled me more than that crisp sentence. Not only did I appreciate and regret the stress I'd caused my fellow students, I realised something else for the first time. You may have no respect for your own work, he said. And my pain at this judgment told me that my involvement in Dramsoc was no passing college fling, but a serious affair. I'd never given it a second's thought, but now felt at least a flicker of understanding that this theatre thing involved giving as much respect and applause as I received. If, that is, I wanted to do it right at all. It is generally understood that going to college may change someone's life. What is not always appreciated is that the life-changing bit can happen not in moments of achievement, but of shame. However, in a story about new insights, I should emphasise that one important detail remains unchanged since that time. Trust me, Ibsen's brand really is boring.
On the 22nd of September 1964, an Irish Independent headline announced UCD Design Competition, won by Pole. Under the headline, a grainy photograph showed the young architect, recently arrived from Warsaw. He was here, of course, to realise his design for Ireland's first modernist, purpose-built university campus at Stillorgan, some 3 miles south of Dublin city centre. His name was André Weihert, and his vision had been chosen out of 105 different proposals from over 20 countries. All were responding to an international architectural competition to make a new master plan for University College Dublin, including an administration building, an Aula Maxima ceremonial space, and a centre for teaching the arts, law and commerce subjects. The proposals had to consider the unapologetically dogmatic and modernist science blocks. Almost complete by 1963 and already partway occupied by daring physics students, these blocks signalled an aesthetic direction for the new campus: low-lying, flat-roofed, monochrome. But mostly these science blocks were technocratic. Apparently NASA sponsored some lab equipment, and after the dysfunctionality and overcrowding of UCD's city centre accommodation in Earlsford Terrace and at Merrion Street, these new light-filled spaces spoke a language of progress. This surely was a brave new world of post-war third-level education. UCD's president, Michael Tierney, though himself a professor of Greek, knew what was needed for Ireland's largest university as the 1960s loomed. seeking to propel UCD beyond Jesuit expectations and forever intrigued by the Victorian visions of Cardinal John Henry Newman, Michael Tierney sought a modernist educational precinct where all faculties would teach and learn together, where students might live, where academics and administrators would happily collaborate. Tierney, after Newman, wanted collegiate connectivity, interdisciplinarity, technological possibility, chance encounter. Of course, such a university utopia could only happen in a greenfield setting. After failed attempts to extend itself within Dublin city centre, and undoubtedly influenced by town planning theories of the late 1940s, UCD's governing body felt compelled to colonise suburbia. Contemporary officialdom decreed that a successful university of an international standard needed as much outdoor as indoor space. And so, following from the college's 1930s purchase of Belfield House in the Stillorgan neighbourhood, Tierney set about acquiring villa after villa, stitching together land parcels so that, by 1961, UCD owned over 200 acres around Belfield. This amounted to a fine sight, and it was enough to overwhelm those dissenting voices who said that UCD really belonged in the centre of Dublin, in the midst of the historic city. Instead, UCD was to become its own city. Well, maybe more like a mid-sized regional town. But the point is that UCD was fearlessly making itself anew at Belfield. As a 1959 university pamphlet asserted, in the matter of buildings, it would not be easy to name a university so ill-provided as University College Dublin. The college is not an institution which has outgrown buildings, but one which, properly speaking, has never been built at all. And so, unburdened by architectural history, the new campus could deliver fresh air and sports grounds, a huge, browsable library, enormous lecture theatres. Ultimately, the Belfield site and the International Architectural Competition represented an opportunity for UCD to establish a less elitist, more democratic university campus as city. So, back to André Weihert. His design was chosen largely because it acknowledged what the competition guidelines referred to as the site's gently undulating parkland. It embedded itself in the villa landscapes of Woodview, Ardmore, Belfield, Belgrove, Merville, White Oaks by means of a dynamic covered walkway. The walkway, like a broken, bent spine, would move people between buildings. Buildings in turn would be added, adapted, grown from this spine. The judges and UCD's governing body admired the elasticity and flexibility underpinning Weihert's plan. After all, this was the 1960s, a time of growth. Who could predict how things would develop? Architecture must then respond to this incompleteness, this partialness, this indeterminacy. Responding instinctively to that anxiety, Weihert's master plan also paid homage to the landscape, to the surrounding palette of greys and greens, making gaps, emphasising sight lines to the mountains and Dublin Bay beyond. Upon arrival on site, Weihert actually changed his original proposal for steel and glass structures. Instead, UCD at Belfield would be hewn from the whitest possible concrete, evoking monumental stone. Straight away, his master plan had to absorb buildings by other architects, such as the University Library and Robin Walker's amazingly elegant and high-tech restaurant, so that tonal continuity was upheld through materials and building height. Belfield's lake was reputedly Weihert's personal favourite element. But it was at that other watery place, the Water Tower, that he would gain acclaim. Soaring to almost 200 feet, this ribbed concrete 12-sided tank containing 150,000 gallons of water, that is, 10 gallons per student in 1970s UCD, soon became a geometric beacon, a landmark on South County Dublin's skyline, UCD's own minaret. Weihert was aware indeed of architecture's role to shape and make places. He once said that an individual is too often lonely and lost in a crowd. And so, through multifunctional architectures, landscape design and the unifying outdoor walkway, Vejherts Belfield set out to resolve precisely that tension for UCD.
As I walked up the avenue from the Clonskilly Gate on the first day of term 1971, the new college floated in the distance on a sea of empty green fields. It looked a bit like the airport. The predominant colour was grey, the grey of a cloudy November day. Grey walkways, grey walls, grey bricks outside and in. Grey is neutral. It allows you to imprint your own mark on it. The colour of Belfield would be created by its people, the teachers and students, their personalities, their characters, their clothes. The colour of Belfield would be in the lectures they were hearing and the books they were reading, the thoughts they were having, the essays they were writing. It would be in their talking and laughing as they moved through the halls on their journey to the rest of their lives. These days, 50 years later, somebody has injected pops of actual colour into the backdrop. There are bright pink and green sofas on the concourse, colourful prints and big photographs of distinguished alumni on the walls. Upstairs, you find cosy nooks in which students can sit and chat, possibly something that was on the mind of the great designer of Belfield, the young Polish architect Andrzej Vejhart, in the first place. He wanted to create a building in which conversation, debate, meetings of minds could take place. In 1971, Belfield was a blank canvas. But the place that made the deepest impression on me and changed my life was a hidden part of Belfield that was anything but blank. Down at the back of the arts block, on the way to the car park, was the Department of Irish Folklore. I first set foot in it at the end of 1972, when I was in second year and about to embark on an elective module called The Folktale and Medieval Literature. Unlike other departments, this one had a door with its name displayed on it. I opened the door and there was an office. The motherly secretary greeted me in Irish. Above her desk was a display of St. Bridget's crosses. Beautiful objects representing the designs of crosses made in various parts of Ireland. Already seeing those crosses made of straw or rushes, I knew I was in a place which was unlike anywhere else in college. Nature had made its way into the monument to modernity that was Belfield, and so had art. There was a second door which the secretary had to open. Ahead was one of the wide Belfield corridors, but this one was more like a magical cave, bedecked with canvases, oil paintings in the rich jewel colours of the 19th century. The Shi Gui, the Pattern at Glendalough, Donnybrook Fair, Eviction. These pictures were talking and they were telling the story of Ireland. At the end of the corridor, the final, the most important door, led to the tabernacle, the archive, always known simply as that, the archive, on Cortlandt. From floor to ceiling, the shelves were stacked with volumes, some brown, some green, the main manuscripts and the school's manuscripts. Take down a volume. It really is a manuscript written by hand. The earlier ones in the old Gaelic alphabet with the funny O's and S's, the later in the more familiar lessons of the English version of the Roman alphabet. A few in what now looks like the quaint typeface of manual typewriters. Open a brown volume from the first stack. IFC, Irish Folklore Commission. IFC 139. On page 3, a story told by Sean McRearty fisherman, age 70, Teelan, County Donegal, in 1935. Collected on an Edifone recorder by Sean O'Hookey, transcribed by him. The story is a long tale about a widow's son who goes out into the world and experiences various adventures, overcomes obstacles, finally marries a princess. It's a wonder tale or fairy tale. The manuscript are full of wonder tales, hero tales, legends, stories, songs, history, collected from fishermen and farmers and housewives in all parts of Ireland, written down and stored here. Because this modest room is the archive of the Irish imagination. Soon I was going to make many interesting discoveries. I would find out that this story, collected in Donegal in 1935, had analogues all over Europe, that it had travelled from one person to another over wide spaces and time. The journey of a story could take hundreds of years, but if a story was good enough and strong enough, it would make the trip from person to person, from India to Ireland, changing and mutating, developing variant forms along the way. I was going to find out that the roots of literature were not, as I had believed in the earliest writing, Beowulf, the Thorn, the Odyssey, but in the stories that had survived Email na Daoine, that had been told and told again and again for thousands of years all over the world. Told, listened to, dependent for survival on being remembered and retold. I was going to find out that many of those stories had been finally captured on tape and other kinds of sound recording, painstakingly transcribed, and were now here in the archive at the bottom of the magical corridor of the Department of Irish Folklore, UCD. This was going to change my view of literature and of learning, and many other aspects of my life.
Marielle Vieira has left her desk and is looking for the parcel of books that has arrived by courier. It's stacked somewhere on one of the desks that are exactly where the pool tables used to sit in the middle of the Belfield bar. I slip into a daydream while I'm waiting. It's 1991 and myself and my friend Johnny Kevill are playing pool on one of those tables. It's winners stay on and we've been here for hours now, holding the table against all comers and drinking pints of Bass. The Bass is 92 pence a pint on special offer. And we are now feeling very special ourselves. I've long hair and I'm wearing dungarees. I'm also wearing a pair of red boot runners that Johnny has defaced with slurs, suggesting that I may be a little bit pretentious. He's not wrong, but I'm only 20 and anyway, I can't wash the ink off. We hold the pool table all evening. At least in the dream we do. But the Belfield Bar isn't a bar anymore. It has been renamed Building 71. The bottom half of the building is now set out for exams. There's even a whiteboard erected up where the long bar counter once supported elbow after elbow. The top end of the bar, where the bands used to play, is now used for storing dozens of huge cardboard boxes, and it's used also for taking in courier packages on a near-deserted campus in the time of COVID. Marielle is still looking for my books, so I dream on, deeper this time. It's 1988 and I walk into that bar for the first time. I get an unreal surge of wonder. The word to describe the atmosphere in the bar that day has yet to be invented. There are men, well, boys who will be men, hanging upside down on the steel beams that run below the ceiling using the curve of their knees. Other boys and girls who will be women are passing them up pints and they're drinking them upside down. I don't remember reading about this stuff in the college prospectus. They are ag students or maybe engineers and they're all from the country, loose in the city. Their world has been remade. I'm with my new friend, Aina O'Sullivan from Teva Cnoic, Brandon in County Kerry. We've come over from an Irish class. It's the middle of the afternoon. I'm about to grow up an awful lot in the time it takes to drink 2 pints. At least, I think it was just 2 pints. 3 at most. We'll stop at 4. Marielle is back with my books. You've to sign for them, she says. We're both wearing masks. She has an easy laugh and it takes any formality out of things. I tell her that it used to be a bar here and she has the manners to pretend it is the first time she has heard this. I walk down towards the old dance floor before leaving, just for a look, to see if the old grime and grunge linger still. The shutters on the bar counter are partly open. I wonder, are Seamus or Deck in there, and do they still have Bass? And in my head, all I can hear is Primal Scream. Bobby Gillespie is singing Damaged. The way I felt inside made me feel so glad to be alive. Got damaged. I got damaged, sings Bobby. Sweat and a boundless raw energy hang in the air. I know that this night won't end here. There is a party in a flat in Ranelagh, and I don't have to get up in the morning, if there is a morning, or maybe not even in the afternoon, because time is unbounded. I say thank you to Marielle, leave the bar, or Building 71, and I head back across the campus to my office. UCD is a different place. The wildness is gone. But as I walk, the ghosts of that wildness are everywhere. The years run one into the next. I head down past Theatre L in the Newman building and remember how nervous I was the first time I sat in a lecture in there. Barely 17, knowing nobody, magnificently clueless, just starting out. And I remember also how nervous I was the first time I taught in there. 520 seats full of history students and me in front of them, about to find out a lot about becoming something different in front of a crowd. I walk on past the blob as the ambiguous sculpture in the middle of the arts concourse is still called. I wonder, does anyone arrange to meet there like we used to at the blob now that everyone has a smartphone? I know the answer before that question is even fully formed. I go up into my office and pull asunder the parcel of books that Marielle has given me. I open the Dictionary of Imaginary Places. It's a magical book. There are brilliant entries on Dracula's Castle and Fredonia from the Marx Brothers film Duck Soup and on hundreds of other pretend lands of film and literature and folklore. The Belfield Bar hasn't made this edition of the dictionary, but it, too, is now an imaginary place, created and recreated only in the memory of generations of students, an imagined land where nobody can get old.
For over 30 years, he lived in quiet corners of the UCD campus. Michael Byrne's footsteps are ingrained in the paths of Woodbine, Nutley and Greenfield, across the N11 flyover into the campus, through the front gates, up the main avenue, by the side of the lake and along the Oak Walk, settling behind Conway when the weather was poor, and over by Rosemont when it was warm. He slipped into buildings, strolled through the science atrium, to the surprise of visiting academics attending conferences. He was a regular in the restaurant, the students' union shop, and at other eateries and cafes where he was given his meals or cups of tea and sat amongst the students. His quiet calmness seemed to spread to the students, osmosis-like. Everyone knew Old Man Belfield, or felt that they did. And in winter, despite the dark, his ever-presence around campus late at night made you feel safe as you headed home. He had a liking for building sites, and estate staff would let contractors know who he was, so that he could be left to come and go as he wished. when Storm Ophelia hit, staff opened one of the annex buildings and he slipped in. Although people regularly offered him umbrellas, raincoats and the like, he rarely accepted anything apart from a cigarette or a cuppa. And when, on the day after his 72nd birthday, we let people know that he had passed on, thousands of messages poured in from students, from graduates, from staff, present and past, and from neighbours who wished to share their deep affection for this fiercely private man who was so much part of the fabric of the university. Michael Byrne didn't have a roof over his head, a home of his own, but he made his home in Belfield campus. Thank you to those who quietly looked out for Michael. And thank you, Michael, for being part of our lives. We will miss you around campus.
UCD Belfield. That's where I learned how to speak my mind. It's where I learned the world was nowhere near as unfathomable as I thought. It's where I learned about the histories and cultural philosophies and institutions that have constructed the world around me, all the way down to the norms that guided the myriad ways people engaged with me, a young queer Black woman. It's where I learned Japanese phrases and massage therapy rules of thumb and how to construct a decent crossword puzzle. Perhaps most crucially, it's where I got a well-tailored crash course in leadership and working under pressure. But let me take you back to my first day, standing by the lake in my trendy weave and my penny's finest, about to become a law student, feeling terrified that this would be the place I'd finally be revealed for the fraud I was sure I was, where I'd finally encounter the room, the person, or the situation that would prove once and for all, no matter the praise that my parents and teachers had heaped on me, I wasn't enough, not smart or good enough. And at the same time, somehow deeply certain, in the way that only a 16-year-old can manage, that this place would be it. I'd finally find true friendship and love and the deep belonging I'd observed in thousands of books and never quite experienced for myself in life. Now, of course, it was both and neither. By the end of second year, I'd made my first real friend, and I'd seen my terror both realized and assuaged. At a debate, someone, a seasoned debater, intelligent and so in my eyes, powerful enough for me to both fear him and crave his validation. He'd shown my case to be a stupid one, and in a room full of people. I had a panic attack in the bathroom afterwards. But in the minutes and hours following, nothing changed. I didn't disappear from the earth, and moreover, this had happened at the same time that nearly all the people within that same powerful cohort had been telling me that I was the one who should lead the LNH, this ancient, prestigious society, the literary and historical society. This was unimpeachable proof that I was still getting away with it. I was tricking everyone into thinking I was something more than I felt myself to be. Somehow I was good enough to lead the LNH, an 18-year-old Black immigrant only even in the university by virtue of a scholarship. The impact this had on my self-esteem was incalculable. Now, in my brief career across law, tech, and venture capital since leaving university, I've managed teams across continents. I have negotiated my way out of a terrifying lawsuit on behalf of a startup, amongst other adventures, and yet nothing has felt more personally stressful than leading the LNH. Learning the hard way that some days, everything that can go wrong will go wrong, and you only get through it by focusing on what's in front of you, making the best, most critically reasoned decision you can. And it helps to have a community there to laugh and cry about it all at the end of the day. And now, from large-scale protest over our abortion debate poster to arguing with the Irish government over who was footing what part of the bill for the EU Commission president's visit, it was just a nonstop, almost surreal roller coaster. Much of achievement in life, I think, comes down to realizing what you're actually capable of. And I don't think I could have figured it out without UCD. Largely because nowhere else seems to have placed anywhere near the same emphasis on student-led activity. There's something for everyone, and there's several someones to do that something with. And if you can't find the society you need, then you start it. My something turned out to be discourse and ideas and bringing people together. The LNH let me learn how to do that, and it made me fearless. As for that campus, perhaps because I saw it first on a sunny day, perhaps because it represented so much of what I was desperate for that my feelings overlay my vision, or maybe there really is an ideal aesthetic balance between the blue waters, the green nature, and the various grays of the landmark buildings. Whatever the reason, I loved the physical UCD from the start, right until the end, excluding perhaps the occasional moment drenched in rain, keyless and scaling the gates of Glenamina student residence. It felt like a Pratchett-esque pocket world, with all the complicated, unconventional beauty and history and idiosyncrasies that that would imply. I remember thinking that when, almost at the end of my time there, I finally found the secret lake. So disorderly and unnecessary and fascinating. Remembering it all now, my mind's eye is drawn both to those high-anxiety, high-pressure moments presiding over LNH events, and also, at the same time, the banal. I am beset with memories of the grassy knoll between the O'Reilly Building and the lake on a rare sunny day, trying to get from the Newman Building to the Student Center and ending up halting at least 4 or 5 times in the concourse to chat with friends. That was my Belfield, a world of its own, filled with, at one time at least, almost everyone I loved and respected, at once a warm, safe haven and a ceaselessly challenging terrain.
That was Sunday Miscellany Belfield Days, a programme marking 50 years of University College Dublin's Belfield campus with the support of UCD. This morning's scripts were Never Too Late by Jerry Stembridge, Why Belfield, Why Veihart? An Architectural History by Ellen Rowley. The Archive of Imagination by Eilish Ní Gluibhne. Then, The Belfield Bar by Paul Rouse. A Tribute to Michael Byrne, Old Man Belfield by Eilish O'Brien. And finally, My Belfield by Daisy Onabog. This morning's music began with I Won't Let You Down by PhD. Then we heard New World Coming by Mama Cass. Then, Gowntree by Michael McGlynn, sung by the Choral Scholars of University College Dublin, conducted by Desmond Early. After that, we heard New Orleans Instrumental No. 1 by R.E.M. And finally, Prelude No. 23 in F Major by Chopin, played on piano by Grigory Sokolov. And Ellen Rowley is the co-editor with Fionnuala O'Kane of a new book, Making Belfield, Space and Place at UCD, published by UCD Press. You can find out more about UCD's Belfield commemorations at ucdbelfield50.com. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.